There is a cup of poison right here. A man is about to grab it and drink it. Now, after the hemlock enters his bloodstream, death will occur. But what kind of death? One of extraordinary importance. You see, this man's death, it set off the age of philosophy. It also set off the debate for the soul. Let's go join Socrates in his last moments. Maybe you got lost somewhere, swimming too far off the beach. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Cause. My name is Rob, and today we're going to be going over the third book in the second volume of the Harvard Classic series, Phaedo by Plato. It is one of the most important dialogues written by Plato, in my opinion, because the story is referenced so much. If you don't have a good understanding of it, you'll kind of miss out on some of the conversations being held. So real quick, let's set the scene up, and then we'll dive into the story. So the scene is, we have Echecrates and Phaedo. They're talking in a place called Phileus, which is about 40 to 50 miles west of Athens. Socrates has died at this point, and Echecrates is basically asking Phaedo what happened. Now, in the cell of Socrates was this group of men, and a cup of poison will later show up that will remove his soul from this earth. And the soul is the topic of this discussion. Let's dive into the story. So the story starts off with Echecrates asking Phaedo the details of Socrates' death. What was said, what was done, who was there. Phaedo says whenever he arrives, the chains are just being kind of taken off of Socrates, and they're allowed to kind of enter the cell and walk in and visit him. Now, many of Socrates' friends and students and stuff will be there kind of to listen. We also need to note at this point that Plato was not there because he was ill, so the writer of this, Plato, will have gotten all this information from secondhand. Socrates' wife, Xanthippe, is there holding her child. And as soon as Phaedo and the crew come in, Xanthippe gets up and she leaves. And she leaves the philosophers to kind of discuss philosophical things. Now, I thought this was kind of strange because you would think as a man dying, he'd want to spend his last moments with his family. And instead, he chooses to spend it with a bunch of philosophers discussing philosophy. Now, comparing our customs and cultures to theirs can be tempting. It tempts me. And sometimes it's hard to see a different point of view when you grew up in a different time period. At this point, Socrates says after being in prison for a little while, he started to pick up some poetry. He's doing some fables and stuff like that. But then the conversation quickly turns to suicide and how wrong it is. And there's a part here that's kind of worded really well, and I want to read it to you real quick. He says, "Why, when a man is better dead, he is not permitted to be his own benefactor, but must wait for the hand of another." He immediately follows it up with this. "There is a doctrine, uttered in secret, that a man is a prisoner who has no right to open the door of his prison and run away." That's some strong comments. If you read through this section, he's basically saying that we are nothing but the possessions of the gods or the god, and we do not have the right to change that. Simmias then asks Socrates if he plans to take his thoughts with him when he dies. This opens up the primary topic of the entire book, which is about the soul. Socrates answers that no true philosopher should be afraid to die. Death and dying is what any true philosopher is in search of. He then asks, is there a thing such as death? Is death anything than just the separation of the soul from the body? And in the last hours of death, do you care about clothes, eating, and drinking? Socrates says most people will be concerned with the soul rather than the body. He then brings up the concept of pure knowledge, because the body tends to hinder the ability to obtain true knowledge or pure knowledge, because our senses lack the ability to achieve maximum understanding and truth. That's how I interpreted this portion of the book. He then goes on to say that the body is just this endless source of trouble. And honestly, if you think about the next few lines, you'll see why. And in speaking of the body, he says, "And by filling us so full of loves and lusts and fears and fancies and idols and every sort of folly, prevents our ever having, as people say, so much as a thought. For whence come wars and fighting and factions? Whence but from the body and the lusts of the body? For wars are occasioned by the love of money, and money has to be acquired for the sake and in the service of the body. And in consequence of all these things, the time which ought to be given to philosophy is lost." That's so true, because we have more time than ever nowadays to study morals, virtues, educate ourselves, and dive deeper into self-improvement. A single iPhone nowadays holds more info than any library has ever held. In a few taps, you can almost listen to any book that has ever been written. But the body tempts me to doom scroll Instagram or binge a new movie series. So instead of discovering who I am, I find myself watching somebody on TV throw a ball around. You do not find your soul in consuming pixels. You find your soul by pushing the limits of who you are capable of being. You find your soul in those deep thoughts, on long runs, early in the mornings. Socrates says, if you want pure knowledge, you have to quit the body. Stop giving in to the temptations, the desires, the lust, the greed. Is not a decent meal and air enough to sustain the day? Socrates says, if pure knowledge is not to be obtained while the soul and the body are mixed, then one of two things has to be true. Either we will never have pure knowledge, or it has to come after death. But what is pure knowledge? Is purification just the separation of the soul from the body? A shedding of this old, used body, which is just life chained to a soul. So that is what we have come to define as death, if you would think of it like Socrates. It's literally just like your soul taking a bath on the day of your death. It's just getting rid of the body. And honestly, it doesn't really sound that bad. And the power of philosophy, I want to point out here, is allowing this man, Socrates, to believe in something very unique and to die with a contentness that can only be found in faith. He says, how inconsistent of them to have been always enemies of the body and wanting to have the soul alone, and when this is granted to them, to be trembling and repining instead of rejoicing at their departing to this place, where when they arrive, they hope to gain that which in life they loved and at the same time be rid of the company of their enemy, that body. Cebes, one of the men in the cell with Socrates, listening, says he agrees with Socrates on mostly everything, mostly. But in what relates to the soul, many men believe that the soul just kind of vanishes upon death. And he says, what arguments do you have against this common belief? Socrates goes into examples of opposites and how creation of new things occur upon something else ending, kind of like a transfer of energy. Upon waking up, you're no longer sleeping, and upon sleeping, you're no longer awake. The form of the energy is still there, but it's just transferred. And we know from the law of the conservation of energy, energy can't be created or destroyed, but only transformed or transferred. Energy cannot just disappear. Upon a flower dying, the seeds within that flower fall to the ground and the new plant grows. So the opposite of a beautiful flower is a dried up dead flower. And from that, a new plant forms, which again produces a flower and seeds. And what is generated from a long life is death. And then what is generated from death is life. The energy of the body cannot just disappear. It has to be transformed into something else. Socrates brings up a good point in regards to cycles or things regenerating repeatedly. He says, if anything continues in a linear movement without regeneration, it basically would be in a permanent static state. You can't continue to work, you eventually have to rest. You can't continue to sleep because you eventually got to wake up. And you can't continue to die because you eventually got to live. And after living, you have to die. Now, this is getting into more of a reincarnation type theory that they're arguing for. And now I want to back up into the Book of Meno, which is not included in the Harvard Classic series. Socrates and Meno debate in that book that knowledge comes in the form of recollection. You're recalling something that you've known in the past, and therefore now you can understand it, or you already know it. And at this point, Cebes brings that up again as proof. He says that knowledge is simply recollection, if true, also necessarily implies a previous time in which we learned that which we now recollect. But this would be impossible unless our soul was in some place before existing in the human form. But what is recollection? How do you prove it? Through questions? Socrates says, what a man recollects, he must have known at some previous time. It's kind of like when I see my dad's toolbox in the shop. My mind immediately recollects the memories we had of those times of fixing things and working on stuff. And this passage here may help you understand. But if the knowledge which we acquired before birth was lost by us at birth, and afterwards by the use of the senses we recovered that which we previously knew, will not that which we call learning be a process of recovering our knowledge, and may not this be rightly termed recollection by us? And if this argument holds true, that we acquired knowledge before birth, then what Socrates says next is very important. He says, then our souls must have existed before they were in the form of a man, without bodies, and must have had intelligence. Now, at this point, they feel they have safely concluded that a soul exists, and it existed before birth. But Simmias and Cebes question what happens to the soul after death. Maybe a strong wind just comes and blows it away into nothingness. Socrates will go into forms in this section, and I think you may want to read the Republic because it kind of goes into more of the forms and stuff like that, and it will give you a better idea of what they're trying to say here. There are two types of existence, things you can see and things you can't see. Many people do not believe in a soul because you can't see it. If you can't see God, he must not exist. This section starts to dive into the metaphysics, which is honestly just the study of things beyond the physical. Like, does gravity exist? You can feel it, but you can't see it. There's no color, there's no taste. Not many of your senses can detect that it's there, but the force is there. What about beauty, lust, love? Can you destroy the concept of beauty? You can change the form into something that may make something not beautiful, but the concept of beauty itself can't be destroyed. Page 73 has a good passage here. But the soul, which has been polluted and is impure at the time of her departure, and is in the companion and servant of the body always, and is in love with and fascinated by the body and by the desires and pleasures of the body, until she is led to believe that the truth only exists in bodily form, which a man may touch and see and taste and use for the purpose of his lusts. The soul, I mean, accustomed to hate and fear and avoid intellectual principle, which to the body eye is dark and invisible and can be attained only by philosophy. Philosophy, like say Christianity, is pursuing an existence beyond just the passions of the body and the materials and its desires. Wisdom, in a sense, is searching for and exploring the soul without the taint of the body. Socrates has a line that fits here perfectly. He says, "The soul is only able to view existence through the bars of a prison and not in her own nature." He believes that if you commit evil, then your soul is tainted, and the lack of purity will not allow you to ascend into the afterlife. Let me just ask this of you. Does the body and the desires of the body not fight you against knowledge? Every time I sit down to study or expand my mind, immediately temptations of social media, emails, games, notifications, and other pleasures like that just beckon my attention, pulling me away from improvement. It's honestly a battle to find your soul. It's a battle to fight that temptation of distraction. It's truly an exercise of discipline, and that's honestly something we don't exercise enough. Socrates, in an eloquent way, warns to not let the soul become too tangled in the desires of the body, for by doing so, life becomes unpleasant. Look for the happiest people around you and observe what they value. Robin Williams and Anthony Bourdain both had amazing careers, but true happiness, I believe, is found somewhere different. At this point in the book, some arguments arise because nobody just truly ever agrees. Argument one from Simmias: what about harmony? You have a nice guitar, you're strumming a melody that's just producing this nice harmony, and the strings break. The broken guitar stops and the melody stops, and therefore the harmony ends. Surely the soul may be in a similar state. Socrates says there is force in that argument and reason. What is the second argument? Argument two from Cebes. He says the soul may wear out 20 bodies before it finally eventually disappears. How do we not know that's not the case? Now, Socrates explains away the harmony argument fairly easily. As he says, harmony begins when the strings start to be moved, and it ends when they stop. But it has already been established that a soul starts before life ever begins. A soul leads where harmony just follows, so therefore they cannot be the same. In reply to CB's argument of the soul just wearing out a bunch of bodies, he says, tell me, what is the inheritance which will render the body alive? The soul? The body does not change upon death, but something in the body does leave it. The form is still there, the blood's still there, the tissue's still there, the bones, the matter is still there. But what leaves it? Something has to leave if it's shut down. His final argument here will prove the immortality of the soul, and he will use the concept of odd numbers and some other methods to prove this. And honestly, I had to read this section a few times to actually kind of get a good grasp of it. So at this point, the time is coming near for Socrates to drink the poison and die. And Crito, being the good guy he is, he asks Socrates, how do you want to be buried? And Socrates says, any way you would like, if you can catch me. Socrates jokes with Crito here because he says, you know, you're still not convinced. I am the soul, not the body. You will not bury me because I won't be here. You can do whatever you want with this body that's left behind, but that's not me. At this point, the jailer, before bringing in the cup with the poison, comes and visits Socrates. And upon turning, he starts to weep because him and Socrates had become close over their time there. They had spoken a good bit. The jailer then comes back with a cup of poison. Socrates grabs it. He holds it up. And I think with a smirk, he says, what do you say about making a libation out of this cup to any god? Then quite readily and cheerfully, he drinks of the cup and polishes it off. At this point, the men in the room can't hold back their tears, as they realize the timer has started at this point. Now, Apollorus, who had been weeping the entire time, starts to just outright cry and bawl. And at this point, Phaedo said it made cowards of us all. Now, Socrates, he's remaining calm and he's looking around. And he says, "What is this strange outcry? I sent away the women, mainly in order that they may not offend in this way. For I have heard a man shall die in peace. Be quiet then, and have patience." The guy who just drank the poison and is about to die is having to calm everybody else around him down. The irony here to me is they all just decided that Socrates' soul would live on in eternity. And the body is nothing more than just a vessel that traps the soul. And now the soul is getting very close to being set free. So why is everybody crying? What is more honest? What you say you believe or the emotions that form in you? Nothing like fear and sadness exposing the truth of what you truly believe. Now Socrates, before taking his last breath, says to Crito, his last words, "I owe a cock to Asclepius. Will you remember to pay the debt?" Such was the end of our friend Socrates, the wise and great teacher of philosophy. Real quick, three quotes I love from the book that I didn't have above. Number one is, "When the soul and the body are united, then nature orders the soul to rule and govern, and the body to obey and serve." Two is not philosophy the practice of death? And three, simple, by beauty, beautiful things become beautiful. I love that. I've truly hoped you enjoyed this episode. If you like this type of content, please consider subscribing, liking, commenting, sharing, and all that. It literally helps the algorithm help push this content, and I would really like it to get out there and help this channel grow. I would love to hear from you in the comments. I answer every comment, so if you go down there and leave a comment, I will be down there to reply. I want to learn from you just as much as, you know, hopefully you're getting from this. And lastly, guys, if you love reading and you love great coffee, then you should check out my link in the description. I source my own green coffee. I roast my coffee. I package it with love and I ship it to you. Go check it out. So again, thank you so much for watching. I will see you next week. We're going to be diving into the Stoics and discussing Epictetus, a slave, philosopher, a character, as you will see. So until we meet again, drink some amazing coffee, read some awesome books, and I'll see you next week. I love y'all. Peace out. Thank you.
I was making lots of noise, busking on the city streets. I came back from Brooklyn, but you didn't come back for me.